Most of the stuff you throw in your shopping cart at the grocery store, you're pretty sure how it got there. The chicken and other meat came from a farm somewhere. The vegetables came from a farm somewhere. The stuff in the boxes, well, it came from a farm sometime. The story on the fish, that's a bit more complicated, and we learn a lot about commercial fishing and how it is regulated in America in a book by Lee Vandervoo called The Fish Market, Inside the Big Money Battle for the Ocean and Your Dinner Plate. Lee Vandervoo is a journalist living in Portland and generally reporting on food, policy, and social justice. Her work has been published far and wide in the likes of the New York Times, Reuters, and CNN, to name a few. Lee is on the staff of Investigate West, a nonprofit journalism operation for the Pacific Northwest. Lee Vandervoo, thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So had you even heard of a catch share before a few years ago?
You know, I hadn't.
Okay, so what is a catch share?
So a catch share is, well, I'll back up. The U.S. puts limits on how much seafood can be caught in a given year, with the idea being that, you know, you want the fish that come out of the water one year to be there in the next, in 10 and 20 years. But the way that that cap is enforced can vary. And beginning in 2010, the U.S. started to favor a new policy tool to enforce it, and that is what a catch share is. And how it works is that the government takes the pie of all the fish that can be caught, if you will, and slices it up and gives the pieces away in ownership to individuals and qualifying companies.
So they would say there'll be 10 million, you know, pike or something in a year. And so you get 3 million, you get 2 million, you get 1, 1, 1, 1, 1.
Right.
Okay. So, wow, how is that all decided?
Well, it's a lot of politicking, if you can imagine. There's years in the tee up until these decisions are made, and an awful lot of jockeying for position among folks who may qualify. A lot of money gets spent in lobbying these decisions. It's interesting. I mean, the bet is, okay, ownership equals good stewardship, right? You give people a stake in the ocean, they'll want to take care of it. But it's a pretty big gamble. It's like giving people houses and betting they're going to cut their grass. You really don't know. And the effects have been pretty mixed.
So does it really mean that rights of the fish are entirely in private hands?
Yes, it does. For commercial catch, yes.
For commercial. Okay. So a lot of your initial briefing on this came from John Enge here in the Rogue Valley. And he sounds fascinating. Who was he?
Oh, John was such a nice guy. Gosh, he ran a blog called Alaska Cafe. He was a fisheries biologist in Alaska for many years, and then he worked in the seafood industry. Really just smart, knowledgeable guy, super connected in the seafood industry, and just collected lots and lots of information on this and was kind enough to have me in his home when I first took an interest in this and spent a few days with me giving me the crash course.
It sounds like he was quite patient, the way you describe it.
He really was.
It is hard to understand. You explain it really well in the book, but there are a lot of different moving parts here.
Yeah, definitely. A lot of bells and levers. I mean, I think the thing, the overarching thing to take away from it is that, you know, some of the folks really did become the good stewards that were hoped for, and they're bringing us these incredible seafood products. But many of these owners today have opted to become landlords. And so the reason why I think this policy is important is it is really creating an environment where, you know, people who are working on the seas are having to rent the right to go to work. It's making the industry harder to climb, and it's starting to unmoor that small business foundation that's been so important to coastal communities since we've had coastal communities. And what's happening is as these properties become available for sale, they're not landing in these towns anymore. They're going to the nearest, deepest pocket, and that's investors and corporations and equity groups. And we're seeing in many ways the value of natural resources from the sea migrate away from coastal towns.
So how long is a cat share? Is it indefinite, or is there a time limit on it? Do you have to reapply for it at some point?
Can you say that again, Jeff? You broke up a little bit.
I'm trying to figure out the length of time of a cat share, whether it's indefinite or whether there's a period for it.
Oh, boy, I'm afraid I'm not hearing you real well.
Oh, okay. The question is basically about cat shares and the ownership rights, whether those are perpetual. Okay, sounds like we had a real problem here with the phones. All right, Lee, we're going to hang up and try to get you back on the line, so I'll just talk people through this until we get up to a break.
Oh, okay, here we go.
Oh, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry.
Not sure what changed there. Sorry, the question was about cat shares themselves and whether they are indefinite or whether they are time limited.
You know, they're indefinite. And the idea is that, you know, it's still legal for the U.S. to untangle them at some point. You know, the government can come in and put an end to them. However, that's been tried in other cat share nations with very mixed results. Because they cost so much money, borrowing, you know, enough to buy enough halibut to run a boat that you can make a living on, you're talking about $250,000 or $300,000. So, you know, banks start taking collateral on those kinds of loans, and they get tangled up in things. Sometimes you see legal trusts step in, depending on who owns what, and it can be very sticky to untangle all those financial arrangements. And so even though it legally can happen, I think the longer that they're in place, the more difficult it becomes.
But as you were just talking about, it sounds like you can lease a catch share. So even if you own it, you don't have to work it yourself.
No, you don't. You can, yeah, you can lease it out. I think the halibut industry in Alaska is the only one that requires fishermen to actually be on board. And oftentimes now the owners just ride. They don't really fish.
All right, so this is where you get up a situation where you've got people who are renters, you've got distant landlords, and the people who call themselves sharecroppers of the sea, all explained in the book The Fish Market by Lee Vandervoo. We'll come back and talk more with Lee in just a few moments and take phone calls and emails from you as we untangle what's going on in commercial fishing around the United States. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Lee Vandervoo and you in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the Portland-based journalist Lee Vandervoo. She's written a really provocative book about how fish is brought in from the oceans around the United States with a focus on the West Coast. The Fish Market, Inside the Big Money Battle for the Ocean and Your Dinner Plate. And it goes into a lot of depth on the subject of catch shares, which are put in place beginning in 2010 in the United States, which really amounts to what some people say is the privatization of the ocean, because when you own a percentage of the catch of fish, you own something that really should belong to the public in some people's minds. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Lee, let's take a little step back in time. Before catch shares, what, if anything, limited the take of any fish?
It was mostly just controls on how long you can fish and what you could fish with in terms of the tools. Think of it like a funnel almost. Regulators would make the season shorter and shorter and shorter to try to control the amount of effort people made at catching fish. It got pretty silly. It definitely didn't work. Up in Alaska, the halibut season was down, about a day, maybe just a little longer than 24 hours, and there was an actual starting gun. It was pretty intense, and it definitely didn't lead to, like, the kind of products that you'd want to eat. You know, all of that fish piling up on the dock in one day, just needing to be frozen just so processors could keep up with it. That's not what we know halibut can bring to the table, so steadying the supply of seafood was definitely one of the aims of the catch share program. And in that sense, it really has boosted values and appetite for wild seafood products.
It makes a certain amount of sense, though, if you're going to extend a season for something, though, and not have starting guns and the derby days, as they're described in the book, that you're probably going to end up having fewer people involved. Is that the case? Are there fewer fishing boats involved now?
Yeah, there definitely has been a lot of industry consolidation that's happened all over the nation. You know, and there's a certain wisdom in pre-assigning that catch and saying, you know, only so-and-so can go catch this season and forever. It gives people greater flexibility. They're not going to go out in bad weather anymore. They're not going to cut their gear off if it gets tangled because they only have another 10 hours to fish and leave that stuff in the water. And they're going to be able to take more time to bring better quality products to market and really start to command a premium for seafood. And those were all things that the nation was after in adopting catch shares. I think the sticking point is simply, couldn't we have gotten there by pre-assigning the catch, say, the way we give leases on timber or leases on the use of mines, rather than simply give those properties away to people and to private markets that now have hold of them.
It sounds like when you talk about the privatization of these markets, too, particularly with the idea of landlords who don't necessarily use the catch shares themselves but lease them out. I mean, has this become a Wall Street kind of investment thing where they figure they can make some money on the rentals and therefore desire to own a catch share for that reason?
That was a question that I had when I went into this, and I would say right now it's more of an individual investor mm-hmm. opportunity. I have seen equity groups come in and buy big chunks of properties, but they usually do it by buying like shelf brands, like for example, Snow's Clam Chowder controls I think a quarter of the quahogs on the East Coast. So when that brand was purchased by Bumblebee Foods and ultimately then purchased by Lion Capital, which is a big British equity group, you know, they weren't necessarily after the quahogs. They were after the brand, that shelf staple of Bumblebee Foods. But, you know, it happens. It happens that these properties do get tangled up in those kinds of Wall Street scenarios, and that is certainly concerning.
So, Lee, you'd begin with the pollock fishery in the Bering Strait at the beginning of the book, and there are some huge numbers of fish in there. Tell us about what you found out there.
Oh, well, pollock is so fascinating. I mean, it really is just the denizen of every sustainable fast food product. And I think, you know, we've gotten pretty hooked on those things, like, well, it's sustainable. I should eat it. I should buy it. So we're talking, you know, the filet of fish sandwich at McDonald's, the Subway seafood sensation. A lot of the Gordon's products, so the fish sticks in the freezer aisle and the fish fillets in the freezer aisle. It's a fish that every year pulls about 2.5 billion pounds out of the water. It's a tremendous fishery. No doubt that it feeds billions of people all over the world for a price that most people can afford, and I think that's why it has the great reputation that it has. But I think, you know, when people hear sustainable seafood, they think of a guy in, you know, like on the Gordon's box and the yellow slicker with a fishing pole out there with the, you know, the wooden captain's wheel. And that's definitely not what's going on in that industry. It's very, very industrial fishery. It always has been. But on the largest boats, you know, you're talking ships as big as a football field with a couple floors, factories on board. That fish is coming off and getting processed into what's called a protein block in the factory immediately, and it comes out on the other side. It looks freakishly like dimensional lumber.
I love that comment in the book, yeah.
That's what you're getting, you know. It hits land, and it just gets fed to the next, you know, batch of conveyor belts. You know, that's not one fish in there. It's probably a bunch of fish all squished together, and that's, you know, that's our protein.
And as you pointed out too, particularly in the case of Gordon's, that it's probably going to fly across the country to get breaded and then come back and be sold again, pretty much close to where it was caught.
Yeah. In the case of those fillet of fish, most of them are processed in Massachusetts. So if you're eating them at a McDonald's that is not in Massachusetts, or it's going to have a lot of air miles by the time it gets to you.
Well, that's pretty amazing. So when this was not an American-only fishery until a few decades ago, once American boats were the only ones working this fishery, and it's because the United States said we get the right to fish 200 miles out. Was that the essence of it?
Yeah, indeed. In the 70s, the U.S. captured the 200 miles off its contiguous shore for the benefit of Americans as a means of locking out foreign competitors. They think, you know, seeing all those bright lights off the west coast of Alaska keep people in that, you know, actually this could be really lucrative and we should get out there. And the U.S. did for a long time provide subsidies to build up fisheries in America, and it's only recently that we've come around to the idea that actually too many boats can be really hard on the environment and started to go the other way, where we're buying boats out and coming up with programs like Catchers to try to control how hard we hit those species.
So were the people who got out of the business let down easily, or was it a bit of a thud? I mean, were they bought out, or did they just have to get out?
You know, it depends on who they were. If they were boat owners, in many cases they were bought out, and, you know, you definitely see people and talk to people who are like, they got a heck of a payday from it, and they were on the edge of retirement. It was a really good deal for them. They took it, and it was, you know, in that sense, not at all an issue. But I think that there was consolidation that nobody planned for, so the effect was maybe there was a guy, say, who ran three boats because he had to have three boats on the water to sustain his empire in the days of the starting gun, right? So he didn't sell any in the buyouts, but perhaps, you know, he didn't need those three boats anymore if he could fish all year, so he dropped two. That was the case in crab. I think initially there was a big boat buyout in the Kodiak area, and they pared down to about 1,300, roughly 1,300 boats. But within a couple of years, they had lost several hundred more. And the impact, I'm sorry, those are jobs, 1,300 jobs, I think went down to about 750. So, you know, the impact was a million or a million and a half in lost wages and revenues came out of the town in annually after that. And those are the kinds of impacts that nobody sees. And those lost jobs, those folks, you know, they don't get buyouts. They were people who were working in the boats, sustaining the industry. They had just as important a role, but they didn't own anything, and they didn't own anything when it was over either.
Lee Vandervoo is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's written a fascinating look at what goes on that gets fish to our table in the country. The book is called The Fish Market, Inside the Big Money Battle for the Ocean and Your Dinner Plate. It gives us very graphic descriptions of what goes on out on the ocean in the boats bringing the fish in and processing them for our consumption on shore. And also gives us a look at things like catch shares, which really regulate who gets involved in the fishing business commercially. So with the catch shares in place, are the fisheries like the pollock in Alaska sustainable?
Well, it's an open question. You know, many of them are sustainably certified. Pollock is sustainably certified. Pollock is an interesting one because it was certified back in the day before the Marine Stewardship Council, which is a kind of the lead certifying agency for fisheries, started certifying forage fish differently than they do others. So pollock, I think, if it had to certify today as opposed to years ago when it did, would have to meet a really different benchmark. Some people say that has downstream consequences for folks who like marine mammals, birds, other species in the Bering Sea that are associated with pollock.
Because humans aren't the only ones who eat pollock.
Yeah, exactly. There's lots of other critters out there. You know, others definitely have seen improvement. If you look at the Gulf of Mexico to red snapper and grouper, certainly those are species that are on the rebound. I think catch shares have helped them.
Well, and as you point out in the book, I mean, there's a great line in here. Every popular fish in America has been nearly fished out of existence. That's pretty stark sounding. But have most of them rebounded somewhat?
Catch shares, they came about at so many different years that it would be hard for me to broad stroke it. But I would say, excepting halibut, most of the catch share. Excepting halibut and cod in New England, most of the catch share fish are pretty stable. Halibut has gone completely the other way for reasons that nobody can really figure out.
That fish has really collapsed.
Yeah, it has, and it's not clear why. You know, sometimes pollock gets talked about as a possible culprit because there is some bycatch of halibut in the pollock fishery, and they are fishing on what would be juvenile halibut ground. So. Mm. But that is purely conjecture. I know it's being studied. I don't know if that's going to lead to the cause, or it could be something to do with weather or currents or ocean things that humans know nothing about.
So I'm curious about a couple of the real finer points of how catch shares work. I mean, in a given year, when and this is a Fishery Management Council that decides what the overall catch is going to be, right?
Yes, it is.
All right. So do they decide on a basis of numbers of fish or on pounds of fish, or is there some other number?
Well, so they decide on how many fish can come out of the water based on, like, a species assessment, and it's usually by the pound, and that then translates to a person's share. So, you know, if you have ownership in shares, they're called quota. They're basically like units of the whole. That'll translate annually into a different number of pounds.
And so who polices this? Who makes sure that that the person who's got a certain catch share doesn't go over that share?
Well, there's documentation that folks have to file when they hit land, and everything is checked at that point. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration does have a law enforcement arm, and a lot of these boats are also subject to Coast Guard inspection.
Let's take a call. We have Tom and Ashland on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about The Fish Market, the book by Lee Vandervoo. Hi, Tom.
Oh, hi. Yeah, with the depletion of the pollock up there, what's the effect on other sea mammals, the sea lions and killer whales?
All right. Well, we got part of that. Let's hear the rest of it. Thanks for that, Tom. Lee, what kind of effect is being seen up there?
Oh, well, there has been thanks, Tom. There has been a decline in marine mammals in the Bering Sea and a decline in birds. There's been a fairly direct relationship between the bird mortality and the pollock industry. There's certain cables that are used on those boats that do have mortality for birds. It's not as clear what's up with the marine mammals. And again, like the halibut, it could be a lot of things. Certainly, if you talk to folks who live out in the Bering Sea on the islands out there, St. Paul, St. George, they'll tell you that they think the fishery has a pretty hard impact on marine mammals. And they actually hunt those mammals and survive on them. They eat them for subsistence. So they're very, very concerned about the declining populations. But there has been a lot of science and study, and it still isn't really clear whether that is an impact from the pollock fishery or something else. Marine mammals do eat pollock, and declining numbers of pollock could, in fact, you know, have an effect on what's available for them to eat or where it is. But there's some science that says that actually they eat much lower in the food chain, and this really is not at issue.
Is there also some question about the effects of climate change on those particular creatures?
Yeah, absolutely, and lots of other things.
All right. So to come back to the some of the finer points of catch shares in the ocean, when you get a catch share, are you given a percentage of the catch for that year?
Yeah, you're exactly. You're given a certain number of units called quota for the whole.
And so, if they get as small as 1%, or are they using bigger increments than that?
Yeah, you could. I mean, you could have a little tiny share. You could have a large share. Some of the fisheries cap how much an individual can own.
We have an email here from Randy in Rouge who writes, "My brother has been a commercial fisherman for 40 years with great success as a small boat owner. His success was a result of his marketing skills and finding a niche for his product, Pisces brand canned albacore. He was the first small boat operator on the West Coast to commercially can his own product, and it's worked out very well for him. But he's not made any friends among the big players in the industry by constantly pointing out illegal and unsustainable practices by the industrial fisheries sector." That, again, from Randy and Roosh. And I imagine you've heard this a few times in your travels, Lee.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Good for him. I think that this ability to really create unique products, to market them on your own and build a really direct relationship with your consumer is the saving grace of many, many a small fleet in America right now. Industrial practices, they are very different from that. And I think that's something that's really misunderstood. You know, people hear sustainable seafood and they think, oh, this is great. You know, this is really just a guy in a boat with a hook and a tackle vest, you know, and it's just, it's so industrial in capture. And I think that was one of the things that I really wanted to get across in writing this book is just the realities of the scale of catch that we're talking about here and the difference between these small boat fishermen and these larger industrial fisheries.
Particularly, I think you mentioned the size of some of these pollock floating factories. They're like 300 feet long, aren't they?
Yeah.
That is a big ship processing fish out on the ocean. A lot to learn about what's going on in ocean fishing and how the things that are caught end up on our dinner tables. The book is called The Fish Market, Inside the Big Money Battle for the Ocean and Your Dinner Plate. We're getting an education here, not only of fishing techniques in the ocean, but about catch shares and a lot of the other finer points of the industry. Lee Vandervoo, our guest. We'll come back and talk more with her and take phone calls and emails from you when we return to the exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about seafood in this hour and getting an education in the mechanics of what goes on out on the ocean, how it gets to market, and what it is that ends up on our plate. The book is called The Fish Market, Inside the Big Money Battle for the Ocean and Your Dinner Plate. Lee Vandervoo, a journalist living in Portland and reporting for some large organizations over the years, joins us to talk about the book she's written. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Lee, I think you touched on this a bit thus far about how catch shares are distributed. They're not, it sounds like, necessarily distributed geographically. So you have some small towns, it sounds like, in Alaska, for example, that just don't have commercial fleets anymore. Is that right?
Yeah, they're not distributed geographically so much. Halibut are, but I think that they're the only one. Oh, maybe New England as well, some of the ground fish there, like the cod. But basically, there are 15 catch shares in the U.S., and they're pretty spread out. So again, back to a fish like a halibut, I think, you know, initially they just get awarded to the folks who were participating at that time in the fishery. But what you'll have is you'll have tiny communities really struggle to keep up with the larger towns. They may not have the services that they need to be as competitive moving forward, like they may not have a bait shop or they may not have enough people left in the marketplace to keep them fishing for certain kinds of species. So they may sell off bit by bit, and the more a small town loses, then the harder they have staying in overall as a community. So we have started to see where, like, really tiny rural communities in Alaska have completely lost access to the commercial halibut. Over time, I mean, it's just a real economic result, is that these properties gravitate toward deeper pockets in towns that are better able to support more industrialized fisheries.
Well, it's not a monopoly per se, because there are other players in it, but it's certainly a small field of players, and it sounds like they're doing rather well financially. Is that a fair assessment from what you looked on several parts of the country?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, for folks who can stay in it, this is a really, really lucrative industry.
All right, so let's get some examples in here. We had talked about the pollock fishery. You talk about the Deadliest Catch, the TV show, and the crab fishery in Alaska. How, for example, did that fishery change with catch shares implemented?
Well, crab is one of those where it shifted to a lease market really early. Now what happens is folks who aren't owners who go out and fish in that marketplace, they're going to pay up to 80% of everything that they earn to their landlord, and in order to be there. Now, the values of crab have so exploded under catch shares that still leaves actually plenty of money for the folks who are out there fishing. But it is true that most of the value of that fishery is, well, let's say a larger share of it retained by folks who are not actively fishing anymore.
So some of these people are actually starting to call themselves sharecroppers, it sounds like, because they're the ones who are doing the work, but they're giving a lot of what they make off to the landlords.
Yeah, they have a lot of names for landlords and different. I found that it was actually sort of dialectic. Like as you move around the country, everybody has different words that they use for their landlords.
What are some of the cleaner ones?
They call them slipper skippers sometimes. Uh-huh. Mailbox fishermen. Some who are particularly rough on their fishermen with little fees and things that they tack on. They call those sharp pencils.
Wow, so it's
pretty colorful vocabulary.
Truly. Now there are some nice folks in here. I mean, you give an example of Continent the Way about Jason De La Cruz. Tell us about how he got started fishing and how he took the plunge in the age of catch shares.
Yeah, Jason is so interesting. Such a smart businessman and really a fascinating guy. I wanted to follow somebody who had been successful in catch shares because I wanted to understand how they did it and what it was like for them. And Jason was an interesting case because he was a guy who was not a fisherman in a commercial sense before all this started. I mean, he was a spear fisherman. He had a commercial permit, but he caught very little, and he had a job as a boat mechanic. It wasn't his main show. But when catch shares came to the Gulf of Mexico and he was fishing grouper, he recognized that if he didn't buy in, he was going to never grow as a fisherman, and it wasn't what he wanted. So he actually mortgaged his house and talked his best friend into mortgaging his house, and they put $500,000 together, and they bought a pretty substantial share of grouper and built a business with it. And so my book follows Jason at a time where he's trying to create really the ultimate sustainable seafood product, in that he wants to figure out if he can trace each individual fish from sea to table through the system. And it's through Jason that I learned a lot about seafood distribution and really how muddy the middle of the food, the supply chain is on seafood, and why he put so much time and energy into trying to innovate it to make it cleaner and more traceable for the consumer.
It sounds like, for example, that's something that might be impossible in the pollock fishery, as you mentioned, with the blocks of protein looking like dimension lumber that you got parts of different fish all squished together.
Yeah, and you know it gets dicey with other fish as well, but for different reasons. Like you mentioned early in the show, consumers are used to beef and chicken, and they know where that stuff comes from. And I think with seafood, what's kind of interesting is that you've got all these distributors in the middle who are the people who have to get seafood to the consumer and sort of bridge the gap between the realities of catching wild fish, which, you know, is affected by seasons and weather and all kinds of natural elements, and the consumer that just wants it to be there, like the chicken and the beef. And there really is a lot of pressure on these folks to make those fish just sort of magically appear,
right.
You know, no matter what nature is doing. And I think that's where you see that it starts to get a little bit tricky in how it passes through the food chain. I mean, supply chain, these are folks that, it's like gasoline. It's a business of pennies, right? They don't make big margins, so they need to keep that fish moving.
All right, so they got to keep it coming in all the time. Let's take another call. We have John and Vanita on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Lee Vander Voo, the author of The Fish Market.
Good morning, Jeff. Good morning, Lee.
Hi.
Good morning.
Very interesting. I'm really fascinated with this. But I have kind of a prickly question. How much money by gross or net, or however you can kind of give a proportionate value to it, does the government get out of this?
Interesting question. So there's got to be something in the way of fees or some other royalties or something coming from the cat shares to the government. How does that work, Lee?
You know, actually, not very well. There are fees paid on, it's like a landing tax when folks bring their fish in, and that money is used to sustain kind of the law enforcement piece of cat shares and the science of managing them. But there is no real significant return to the public on these from this marketplace. So folks who are renting their catch out, and seeing, you know, 80% of the value of a trip, the government isn't seeing any profit on that, and hence the public isn't either. Same with sales of cat shares. There's no return to the public or the government on those.
Does the government sell the cat shares, or can the people who own them sell them?
People who own them sell them, and depending on where they live, they sell them in different ways. Out on the West Coast here, we actually have brokerages that handle those sales. On the East Coast, they don't, or in the Gulf of Mexico, so it's like a Craigslist deal.
All right, so there's money changing hands there, and it sounds like the government doesn't get anything out of that transaction.
No, there's really no significant return to the public from this system.
Which is one of the complaints, I understand, from reading the book, is that it's sort of like with the 1872 mining law and the no royalties.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's unlike other natural resources, I think, in that way. Like when we let leases on timber, for example, or oil, the public is seeing a return on that over time. With cat shares, that's not the case.
All right, let's get a little really close to home here, because obviously you've been through the Rogue Valley a few times just in compiling the book, and got to Port Orford to talk to the folks at Port Orford Sustainable Seafood. You talked to Aaron Longton, who's been on the program a couple of times. What makes that fishery unique at Port Orford, aside from the fact that their boats are all kept on dry land and swung into the water on a big boom?
Yeah, Aaron was kind enough to take me out fishing one day, and I do think that Port Orford and Brookings and some of our smaller Oregon town with our small boat fisheries are really, really unique. Reason being that the catch here on the West Coast, it's called the West Coast groundfish fishery. There's 90 plus species in it. So you're talking about, you know, your rockfish and your flounders and soles, and those formerly were really hard hit by trawl. So our catcher came in on the West Coast, and with an attempt to right that, the objective was to reduce the amount of fish that were caught accidentally, either too young or just the wrong species by trawl boats.
So the trawlers use nets, and the current fleet uses line caught. Is that the difference?
Yes, yeah. Yes. Thanks for that clarification. Yes. Yeah, so what happened was that, in effect, in trying to sort of contain the accidental catch of the trawl, in creating the catch share, regulators basically put kind of set in stone that these would be trawl caught fish, 90% of them, forever. And that's tough on small boats. Now, granted, trawl boats were catching 90% of the fish in the first place. That's why they were allowed to keep that share. But they were also responsible for a lot of the damage. So now, you know, you have these tiny towns like Port Orford that have these small boats with hooks and lines that probably catch fish arguably more sustainably than any other type of operation, and they're relegated to 10% of the catch forever. It makes it really, really difficult for them to, you know, there's a glass ceiling there. They're not going to grow. So they have to really build premiums into the little that they can catch. And I think that Port Orford Sustainable Seafood has been really, really good at doing that, really successful and sort of engendering support for coastal neighbors from inland communities by bringing that fish and land and putting a premium on locally caught catch and on the relationship that consumers can have with their fishermen. I think that's going to be a godsend for little towns that are not going to be able to expand their fisheries in the system.
The name does seem like it's really grown over the years, just since we first started talking to Port Orford Sustainable Seafood. There is, as you report in the book, some potential for greenwashing, that people will use cat shares to say, hey, look, you know, we've really doing this great sustainable thing. You find some flaws there.
Well, you know, I think the West Coast can be a good example. Well, I think consumers that go in for sustainable seafood care about more than just the fish being there again next year. I think that they really care more holistically, like they're interested in worker rights and the sovereignty of communities that live near the oceans as well. I don't think when they hear sustainable seafood, they imagine that people are getting locked out of the sea or being converted into sharecroppers and having to pay, you know, a certain percentage of everything they earn to somebody who doesn't even go fishing with them. And, you know, on the West Coast here, you know, the fact of the matter is that 20% of those boats in our fisheries, our with our groundfish catch share, were skippered by renters in the first year of the program. And I don't think there could be any stronger evidence that these programs really lend themselves toward sharecropping. I think that would be a disappointment to a great number of people who are interested in buying a sustainable product.
So, Lee, before we go, and we're getting close, how do people buy fish? What do we recommend for people when they go to the fish market? What should we be looking for?
You know, I always like to tell people that when in doubt, buy American. You know, we really do have some of the most sustainable, best-managed fisheries in the world in spite of these problems. But if you want to go a little further, know your fishermen. Participate with a program like Port Orford Sustainable Seafood or just have a fishmonger who can tell you what you're getting.
It's a really amazing book. It's called The Fish Market, Inside the Big Money Battle for the Ocean and Your Dinner Plate. And we haven't told you half the stories that happen on board the fishing boats themselves, which Lee can tell you about in another conversation. Lee Vandervoo, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.